This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Hey, junkies, welcome to a dangerously fast new episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation filmcast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me as per usual is my co-host.
He's the fattening in your junk food.
Everything that's fattening about my junk food, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
That is endearing, question mark?
Question mark, question mark?
Question mark, question mark. And this is, of course, still the summer of 86. One junkie summer rolls on.
Winding down, but rolling on.
That could also be a good tagline for this show, which, if you want to hear more of, you can find our back catalog episodes for free on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like the show, why not consider becoming a patron? You can pledge to give a certain amount per episode, and in exchange, we kick you some bonus content that only you get to hear as a patron.
Like this week's Junk Food a la Mode.
Oh my God, I'm so excited for that.
We're reviewing a film that we're both very excited about and that ties into this week's theme.
Absolutely. And I've actually just, if you go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, you'll see that I've added a new flex goal. We're currently at $240 an episode. If we get to $300, I'm adding another bonus show where any of you patrons can send me a movie and I have to watch and review it no matter what it is. So it's sort of truth or dare type of situation.
I have a friend that plays that game at home.
Oof.
He started it several years ago. It's his alphabetical movie project. Mm-hmm. And he's watching, he realized that he owned all these DVDs. He bought DVDs and Blu-rays constantly, but then he never watched them. So he's like, I'm going to watch everything in my collection at least once. So I'm going to watch it from A to Z. I'm going to go through the entire collection, and then I'm going to blog about my experiences watching all these movies. Hey, any of you friends that want to send me something that you think I need to watch, just send it to me and I have to watch it. And so ever since then, every time he gets to a new letter, I send him the worst movie I can think of with that letter.
Nice.
And one time, the time he really questioned whether we were friends or not was when he was in the L's. And I sent him the Look Who's Talking box set.
Oh, fuck you.
with all three Look Who's Talking movies. Look Who's Talking Now, and was it Look Who's Talking
It's Look
to?
Who's Talking, Look Who's Talking To.
Yeah, and then Look Who's Talking Now.
Which is look where how Roseanne... far John Travolta has fallen. Look at this glorious failure. Look upon my deeds in despair. Yeah, it just keeps going.
Then he got to M, and I sent him Molly.
Oof.
And he's currently going through. He's in the ends right now, and I sent him No Holds Barred. It's No Holds Barred. He's gonna have fun with it.
Yeah.
And I don't try to truly punish him. Like, I feel really bad about the Look Who's Talking thing, so I've sent him like cool bad stuff. Because Q, what are you gonna send somebody for Q?
Q the Winged Serpent.
You're goddamn right, you dude. 1982's Q the Winged Serpent.
This could be a fun game, too. Like,
it is.
No. Just between you and me, the guess what movie I'm thinking of that starts with this letter, because I feel like we would be, like, freakishly good at that at
Except
a level that would
never
make...
would have gotten Look Who's Talking, especially not that I sent him the box set.
No, I wouldn't have gotten that, but I feel like that's the kind of game that we would be so good at that it would make everyone in the room, especially our respective significant others, very uncomfortable with how good we are at that game.
My friend, the big true fuck you of Molly was my friend has an autistic child.
Oh, for fuck's sake, dude.
And so the entire movie, he's just pulling his hair out because he's like, this isn't how any of this works. Like, this is not, this is all wrong. Like, every bit of this is wrong. Like, this is bad. And then he get to the Molly Hot scene and he fucking lost his shit. It was amazing. But thankfully, yeah, he's a professional comedian. So, you know, this is somebody who appreciates the gentle ball kicking that is going on here. But
yeah, so become a patron and back us, guys.
I mentioned all this because I'm really excited because you guys now get to play this with Brian.
Yeah,
so
it's going to hurt.
If we can hit that stretch goal, you guys can torment Brian with the craziest, most fucked up shit possible, and then occasionally send him something really cool to throw him off base and go, guys, this is actually really good. What are you doing? And then hit him again with something really awful.
It's like the Pepsi's challenge, except I'm going to be suffering a lot throughout the course of it. And I'm sure since it's just going to be me recording it, there's going to be a lot of
it's like the Pepsi challenge if they left the Pepsi in a cup in a car all day in the summer in Texas.
Oh, sure.
And then chilled it again and you had to drink that.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. It is horrifyingly like that. So yeah, definitely help us get to $300 so I can commit cinema masochism just like that.
Cinemasochism.
I think we just found a name for
it. Named that thing.
Yeah, I'm doing.
All right, well, let's get on to why we're here this week.
Yes, I thought I told you that we won't stop. I thought I told you that we won't stop. We definitely won't stop to pick up Hitchhikers, because if there's one thing this week's movie teaches us, it's how dangerous that can be. And we are talking about the 1986 road comedy, The Hitcher.
When Jim Halsey let the Hitcher into his car, he opened the doors of hell.
What do you want?
I want you to stop me.
This morning, this guy tried to kill me. He's been following me ever since. I didn't do it. I didn't do any of it. I'm not a killer.
Hold on!
Why are you doing this to me?
You're a smart kid. I'll figure it out.
Once you've met the Hitcher, you'll never pick up another.
Yeah, road comedy.
Yes, it's hilarious.
Oddly enough, this hilarious is an era in which there were a lot of road comedies.
Yeah, this one snuffs
this
them
is
all
not
out.
One of them.
No, it's not by the. If you can't tell from the sarcasm, this is not a comedy at all. This is a horror film, written by Eric Red.
The Eric Red, aka Eric the Red.
Yes,
writer and director, who first came to prominence when he had a short film that was featured as one of the primetime features on Night Flight in the early 80s, would go on to write The Hitcher and then follow this up with what Brian and I agree is the greatest vampire film ever fucking made.
Near Dark. Yeah. So, and by the way, also wrote a movie that I think is, wrote and directed a movie that I actually really enjoyed that I discovered a couple years ago called Cohen and Tate.
Oh, yeah. Conan Tate is cool.
It's a very strange movie, and we'll probably end up talking about it at some point on the show, but The Hitcher
is... We should do it a double feature with that and Nathan Hayes.
Yes, yes. All of the ants. It's just the ampersand double feature.
With Nates.
This is... The Hitcher is one of the most simple screenplays you will ever find in your entire life. The story is very easy for me to describe to you. Guy on a road trip picks up a hitchhiker. That hitchhiker proceeds to torment him across the entire breadth of the state. Go. That's it. That's the whole story. It's 98 minutes of that, which on the surface sounds like, how is that possibly sustainable? How can you create drama? By the way, when I say across the country, when I say he's driving across the state, he is driving across the most barren parts of the American Southwest.
Supposedly the whole thing takes place in Texas.
That's right.
And he's driving across West Texas, which if you've ever been across, that's a hell of a thing.
Yeah, the whole movie feels like it takes place in one of those fake towns they set up to test the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
Like that's how, like, there are people living here, but it feels so scarce as to feel like one of those fake towns they set up specifically to test the atomic bomb. It's everything's dusty, everything feels like No one wants to be there. No one wants to live there. Everyone's trying to get out of there. It's just got this very desolate feel to it. And this is what our drama is driving through. And if there is a common theme between this week's main topic film and our patron minisode, both of these films feature characters who are just forces of chaotic nature that you never want to cross paths with. Rutger Hauer in this film as John Ryder, the actual hitcher, the guy was birthed from bad news. Like he is a child of the maw of hell itself. Like there, he doesn't exist anywhere but in horror.
Yeah, he's a bit unnatural, which is, if this movie has one flaw, it's that as gritty and raw as it is,
mm-hmm.
It's not entirely rooted in reality. Like there, you have to kind of excuse a few things. It all makes logical sense for the most part, but is deeply cinematic in it's asking you to suspend disbelief during certain segments of it. That said, it's awesome when he does. Like when he does the things that are strange, they work. There's never a moment where you're like, oh, come on, that's not physically possible.
Yeah.
It's all like, this is all very convenient. Like, I'm not somebody who gives into that, but this movie does stretch credulity just a bit at places to where you're like, oh, you were almost just right on to how deep into this you are. But
yeah.
At the same time, this story could never be told in this manner without stretching that credulity.
Well, and it's because Rutger Hauer is not, there's nothing revealed to be supernatural about him, but everything works and makes more sense if there is something supernatural about him. So in other words, the audience just is left to presume that he is not human. The audience is left to presume that he is some sort of evil incarnate, that he's not really human, but that's never
mentioned. It's like an evil Mr. Meeseeks where existence is awful and he just wants to die and complete his job.
Yeah, and one of the moments, you know, I was struggling for a second thinking I might disagree with you about what you said about it not being rooted in reality, and then I remember the scene where he leaps from a bus onto a truck, and it's not the leap, it's not the landing, it's not surviving it. It is the fact that there is a lion's roar when he jumps off the back of that bus, and you're like, where the fuck is that roar coming from? And it's, I think, you know, Rutger Hauer himself has talked about how he considers the character to just be the representation of evil itself. So an agent of the devil, some kind of demon, some kind of vengeful spirit, whatever you might want to assign to it. It's never spoon-fed to the audience. It's never really decided upon, but... Yeah.
And that's also what's great about this film. I mean, the thing is this film is super lean.
Yeah.
It is super lean and in a good way, not in a lazy way. Like we've cut this to the bone. The very first line of dialogue uttered in this movie is C. Thomas Howell leaning over as he's opening the door for Rutger Hauer and says, "My mother told me I should never do this.
My mother told me never to do this."
Before many miles, he'll wish he'd taken his mom's advice.
In that moment, we already set up, we tell the audience everything we need to know about who he is, about what this situation is, about how dangerous it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this great slow burn scene of very taut dialogue in which C. Thomas Howell is trying to make small talk. He's trying to be a nice guy. And we end up with a scene that has actually become parodied a number of times since I've actually seen half a dozen short films in festivals that have essentially redone this scene where it's the crazy hitchhiker.
Yeah.
And he slowly gets up to the point to where you have what becomes so great about this movie is this crescendo of taut setup. Big fucking reveal. And the big fucking reveal in the first part of this movie is the, oh, hey, by the way, I'm going to kill you. And the way he does it is just so great. This, you know, he's like, do you do you think that was him? Yeah, he wasn't. He probably didn't get too far. Why not?
Because I cut off his legs.
And then I cut off his arms.
And I cut off his head.
And I'm going to do the same to you. And at that point, you're like, holy shit. Like, yeah. I knew this is a crazy hitchhiker movie, but Jesus Christ, does it get into the crazy hitchhiker right fucking away? Like, yeah. What I love about this movie, what I find so interesting, is it is the antithesis of
Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
No. Of three-act structure in the modern age. Like, it technically follows three-act structure.
But every act is the same conflict. Every act is the same. Like, every act could be its own mini movie.
Yeah.
With the same rise and fall at the same point.
But the thing is the moment that he reveals what that is at the moment that the inciting incident happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the moment 9 through 12 bit that, oh, hey, this is where things kind of change for our character. But you don't truly set up the conflict in what the movie is until about minute 25. Like, that's normal three act structure. So what if you were to make this movie today? I haven't seen the Hitcher remake, so I don't know if they did this there or not. But if you were to make this movie today, what would people would insist on is we would be getting to know the character, and the inciting incident would be picking up the hitchhiker, and then everything, you know, would be going to shit 10 minutes after that, and then we would have him kick him out of the car at minute 25, and that's now a movie's on. And that's not how it does it. We get right the fuck into it. This movie just goes, oh, hey, by the way, your first act turn, minute 9, and we're off. And that's the rest of the movie. And it's just so brazen how it does that. Now, it does alter the movie in a slight way by introducing the conflict with the police at about minute 25 at that point.
Yeah.
And that's actually where this movie kind of strains credulity at certain points, is only when it's dealing with the police. Like, that's the problem I have with this movie in its nature, but we'll get more into that. But structurally speaking, this movie just gets off to the fucking races and says, fuck exposition. You don't need to know what this guy does for a living. We don't need to know if he has a girlfriend. We don't need to see him driving and having a good time on his cross country track. We don't need to see him pick up the car. We don't need to see any of this. Like, we want to get right to the hitchhiker, so fuck it. The first, he's driving, he's tired, he sees a hitchhiker in minute 1, bam, he picks him up, utters that phrase, my mother told me I shouldn't be doing this, and bam, we're off to the races in a weird scene that climaxes in, holy shit, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
And then from that moment on, the game is afoot, except... And this is what I love about this, and this is what I love about the concept of who John Ryder is. Rutger Hauer's playing, he introduces himself as John Ryder.
Which was basically him not saying, I'm Mark Passenger.
Yeah.
I'm Bob Evil.
Yes. Yes, that is exactly what it is. But it's essentially the only thing you can really extrapolate from this is one of two things. One, he is just a being of pure evil.
Yeah.
As has been stated. Or two, the moment after that happens, he is about to kill C. Thomas Howell. And right when he does, C. Thomas Howell has noticed the door is still a little bit ajar. He kicks him out and speeds off. And Rutger Hauer finally, when he comes to, he looks up and he smiles. And at that moment, the only interpretation that I think works beyond just him being evil for the sake of being evil is, this guy beat me. This is the only person who's beat me.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, this is what I've been waiting for. Now I have someone to play with.
Yeah.
And he's been looking the whole time for someone with the stones to fuck with him and challenge him so that that person is worth putting through the ringer.
Yeah.
And from that point on, that's exactly what he does, is he sets it up to make it look like he's been on this big killing spree. And he sets it up to see Thomas Howell appear to be the serial killer and set the Texas police onto him.
Yeah. And it really is all about that game. I mean, there's a great line of dialogue where C. Thomas Howell says, you know, after he says, you know, I'm going to kill you, and this dialogue is kind of pulled the curtain back, which, again, I think is just the dialogue in this movie and how concise it is and how economical it is and how much is being said with so few words is remarkable. But C. Thomas Howell says, "What do you want?" And John Ryder says, "I want you to stop me."
Yeah.
He could have killed C. Thomas Howell at any point. There are so many moments in this film where he's got C. Thomas Howell dead to rights, could have just run him over, could have just shot him. It would have been over.
Hell, right at the beginning.
Yeah.
The first time we really see that he's fucking with him, when he killed everyone in the police station and unlocks the door, he could have just walked in and killed him.
Yeah, C. Like, Thomas Howell's asleep. He could have killed him in his sleep, and it would have been over. But it's about that game. It's almost like this Old Testament sort of dragging somebody good through the muck and through hell just to prove something. It's almost like a Job situation. Like John Ryder is trying to prove to God that he can destroy someone.
And what I love about that opening moment when we first start that game is there's actually something smart C. Thomas Howell could have done, and he doesn't do it. And as a result, what he does spins his life entirely out of control. And I love that there's this thing right there, because he could just run back into the cell and lock the cell and be like,
yeah, I thought about that too.
Like, what? Well, yeah, because it's really obvious. It's right there. But that's not what he does. What he does is he grabs a gun and runs.
Yeah.
And, you know, gets up into the hills so that the police can't see him, and then just is on the run ever since. And from that point on, of course, he looks guilty.
Yeah.
But the moment where this movie, I feel strains credulity the most is when he gets arrested that first time, why he gets arrested. And, you know, that clearly the cops are wrong. Clearly they got the wrong guy. As they're walking him off, the sheriff is like, you know, that kid ain't no killer.
Anyone can
look at him and see that. Like, but he's booking him anyway. Like, it's one of those things where it's like these cops, because they're being idiots and because they're being assholes, create this situation, and they do so at a level that just narratively they haven't earned.
See, I had a different interpretation of that scene, actually. I, in that moment, felt the most sympathetic toward the police, because I didn't feel like he was saying, you know, he's obviously not the killer, but let's book him anyway. To me, it was more of a like, this situation is still unfolding, so we're going to hang on to him until we figure out what the hell is really going on. I actually thought that was something of a break from what you normally see in movies like this. When you see small town police, especially when you see, you know, small town Texas police, like, you're more inclined to see cops that are very prejudicial, who don't give a shit about due process, who don't will not give the benefit of the doubt to anyone. And there's a moment of benefit of the doubt here that I thought was actually pretty interesting. And I guess I had a different interpretation of it. But I also think it's interesting that the more movies you watch, especially the more genre stuff and smaller films you watch, you notice that there's like a whole subset of cliches. There's a whole subset of rules that you don't normally think about. And one of them that came to my mind thinking about that same scene, why didn't he just lock the door and stay in there? Good guys never know how to cover their tracks because they never think they're going to need to.
That is, yeah, no, and that's
its own trope, and that's a thing that it's a trope you don't even really think about until you see it in movies, and it's like, why didn't they just do that? Because they never sit around thinking about how to get away with things because they're good guys, and if he was skilled at covering his tracks and getting away with it and smooth talking, you would start to, as an audience member, pull your support away a little bit. You'd start to become dubious that he is a good guy. So I think it's interesting. It's the way it had to work. I had that same thought. Like, why don't you just lock it and throw it? Like, I even went so far as to think, oh, if you need the keys to lock it, go get it off the cop, lock the door, and then throw it out the cell window so they don't see that you have the keys on you. Because apparently I'm not a very good person, because I'm thinking about how to cover my tracks at all points. But it is an interesting trope that you don't necessarily think about.
Well, and this was a trope that we were seeing especially very heavily in 1986, for fuck's sake. But in this era of filmmaking, the idea of the everyman hero, the bumbling everyman hero, the guy who is just not the guy who stumbled into the wrong fucking movie. Like, some of the best movies of this era are, you know, guys who are in the wrong fucking movie. Jack Burton is a great example of that. He's the prime example of the everyman. You know, Bruce Willis in Die Hard. You know, sure. John McClane.
Why didn't John McClane put his shoes on?
Well, why didn't you?
Why did? I'll go back even further. Why did Cary Grant touch the knife in that guy's back in North by Northwest?
Yeah.
Because he doesn't know that you're not supposed to do that because he's not a villain.
Yeah, because he's an everyman. And that's what C. Thomas Howell very much is here. And that's where I also really connected with him. Like, when he runs, I'm like, that's stupid. Well, yeah, of course it's stupid. What the fuck are you going to do? Like, the you've already run into the cops, and the cops are already dicks.
Yeah.
Like, you can't trust the fucking cops in this movie. And no, you can't trust the fucking cops in this movie. And that's what I fucking love about it, is he's stuck between shitty Texas 1980s cops and a fucking evil, brilliant serial killer who could shoot down helicopters with a handgun.
Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ.
Again, stretch his credulity just a bit. I'm not saying you can't do it.
Stretch his credulity of a movie, perhaps. Stretching the credulity of playing Grand Theft Auto, not so much.
Not
because
so much.
That's what that whole chase
that
feels
chase
like.
That chase scene is Grand Theft Auto.
He's in the car with Jennifer Jason Leigh, and they're running from the cops because they don't know what else to do, and he's like, shoot back, and then every time she tries to shoot back, it just goes wrong. More cop cars show up. They finally get rid of the cop cars. Then they go up to a 5-star rating, so the fucking helicopter shows up, and who comes along but this side character who, with a python, fucking shoots down the helicopter with a couple of shots. And that's actually a really good segue into one of the things that is most remarkable about this movie, is that it's clearly a low budget film, but that stunt work is
the automotive
next
stunt work
level amazing.
Well, it's not just the stunt work is really, really fantastic. The stunt work plus the cinematography.
Yes.
Evokes one movie in particular that, while I was watching this, I was like, holy shit. This movie wants to be Mad Max so bad.
Oh, it's definitely. Yeah.
So bad. But in the best way, like in that way that the director clearly sat there and goes, you know what this movie needs to be? It needs to be Mad Max. Like, we need these low angle camera shots. We need these wide sweeping shots of these desert vistas. We need close ups on the driver. We need the soundtrack to be of these fucking V8 engines just chewing up the road. We need like that. And that's exactly what this is. Like, it is very much a love letter to what George Miller did.
It
tied up with this great taut serial killer or / spree killer script by Eric Red. Like, it is so good. But yeah, the crashes in this, I would put up there with Mad Max.
Like, I absolutely would agree.
Pure orchestrated mayhem, like the slow motion shot of those two police cars
flipping,
like turning in front of the car and then flipping together.
Yeah.
It's just like, holy fuck, those stuntmen fucking nailed that stunt.
Yeah.
And the cameraman fucking nailed that shot, like, in a way, like, I know that when they were watching the dailies, they're like, that's the shot that's going to sell this movie.
That's the trailer shot.
That's the trailer shot.
That's like, your money shot for the trailer.
Shit.
I absolutely agree. And not only that, but the helicopter we were talking about, they drop a fucking helicopter onto a highway.
Yeah.
They pick it up, and it's one shot all the way down that must have been attached to a crane, and they just drop that motherfucker right on the highway,
and
it explodes.
Right the fuck up.
I have never seen anything like that, where they literally, you know, most of the time it's edited in such a way where it's falling and then it hits and then it explodes. No, this is one fluid shot of it's midair and it comes crashing down onto the pavement. It is remarkable. There's another shot where Rutger Hauer blows up a gas station and the truck comes barreling out of the flames and it's on fire. And one of the things I read doing research is that Rutger Hauer did a lot of his own stunt driving in this movie, which completely like blew away the stunt drivers. They could not believe that any actor would do the kind of dangerous things that he was just completely in for. And the shot where the truck is on fire and it's just speeding away and everything's exploding behind him, and you just can't believe the amount of spectacle that they're able to create in a nothing landscape.
Yeah.
Like, how do you create, like, that is, and that's another thing that's very George Miller. It's you take a wide open expanse with very little to work with, very little to play off of, and you create majesty of carnage in a way that is just eye popping. And all of this while, and this is what is so brilliant about this film, you've got the George Miller influence. I think the other influence of this movie is definitely Alfred Hitchcock, not just because of the everyman
protagonist. Oh, no, it's definitely a Hitchcock thriller.
Because there are these playfully, these very playfully moody angles that are being chosen, the way that light is being used. One of my favorite things that happens in this movie is the very beginning in the conversation, which is just your basic, it's your basic two shot. But every time they cut to Rutger Hauer, he's almost completely in darkness until just this like small shaft of light will pass. It's just like when you're on a road trip at night with someone and you don't really see them in the passenger seat until, you know, another car goes by or you pass a street light. It is that, and that is the kind of thing that if you were in a big Hollywood movie with big Hollywood stars, that's something you can imagine a star is going to balk at, the idea that they're basically unseen. Like, they're not getting their moment in the camera. They are very much obscured by that darkness, but it works so well to create that mood and to build that tension. And there's another, like, there are shots in this movie that I kept thinking about Hitchcock and the way that Hitchcock used to delight in fucking with audiences.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the ways he would do that is he would painstakingly plan shots that were withholding and then revealing in a way that was very playful but also very dramatic. And there's a great shot in the hotel room where it pans over from the bed. Jennifer Jason Leigh is sleeping. The room is completely dark, and then a car goes by and you see him standing in the corner. He's just standing there. Oh my God. Like that, like I have like a DOP erection just watching all of the shots in this movie. Like, oh my God, it's incredible.
No, it's such an elegantly shot film.
Elegant is the perfect word for it.
But no, Hitch, I mean, this is very much, this is the psychotic Strangers on a Train. Like, this really is. And that, the plot-wise, that's what
Strangers
is.
Strangers on the road.
Well, it's the Hitchcocker.
Yeah.
Like, I can't believe I was the one that had to go there.
God damn
it. I thought setting that up the whole
time. Oh.
Like that.
Hey,
no,
when,
but it
when,
is,
you, when I'm beat, I'm beat.
It's Strangers on a Train, whereas you have like a movie like Disturbia, which is very clearly Rear Window. This is Strangers on a Train. Mm-hmm. It's these two guys just happen to cross paths at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And happen to be, you know, and from that point on, it's one guy playing with the other guy, trying to get him to do what no one else will do, which appears to be in this film, he wants to die.
Yeah.
Like, Rutger Hauer's John Ryder wants to die, and he wants to take this sweet guy.
He wants to take his innocence with him.
And he wants to destroy the innocence, and he wants to make him kill him. And that's what he's working towards the whole time. And that is his end game.
Yeah.
And that's why he's so happy at the end when he's getting killed.
Yeah, I think that's why, I mean, obviously not to spoil it, but come on, guys. But that's why I think John Ryder wins. Like, that's...
Oh, John Ryder... with that final shot? That final shot, as the credits roll, tell us he won.
Yeah.
Like, it's C. Thomas Howell in another Mad Max shot, you know, the sun setting behind the car, you know, the car's there, you know, C. Thomas Howell has his hands on a car, his head's down. He's lost. Like, that is not the pose of victory.
No.
He has just slain the beast.
Yeah.
And he has become the thing that he's been fighting the whole movie.
It's his John Milton moment.
It's such a dark ending. In fact, not only is that part dark, holy shit, we need to talk about the female role in this movie.
Yes, Nash, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, whom he meets at a roadside diner, because this is very much, this stretch very much has that feel of Route 66. I mean, or in this case, I feel like it'd be Route 666. But she's working in a diner. They cross paths because he's trying to use the phone to call the police. She has to choose. This is a very interesting moment where, like, immediately after they meet, the police swarm in and arrest C. Thomas Howell, and she has to choose whether to believe that he is, whether he's good. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a driving force for a little bit, and then once she's made that decision, which there is a moment where
by the way, is the best moment in this movie.
Yes.
Like, it is a moment that is so good, it is a fist in the air moment of just how great a fucking brilliant character moment it is, that we'll get into that, but yeah.
So she is going along with him. She's witnessed a lot. She comes to witness a lot of the evil that is John Ryder, and they're sticking it out. And then,
but she doesn't really seem to believe he exists until she actually sees him.
That's
the moment
true.
She sees him is like, and she flips the fuck out. Why didn't he kill us?
Yeah.
Why didn't he kill it? Like, she's flipping out. She's like, holy shit, this is real, and that guy's nuts. What the fuck is... Like, she doesn't even fully believe the insanity of the situation until she's neck deep in it, and she's finally like, see, Thomas Alva was like, I know, right? I fucking know, right? Like, you expect him to just be like, fucking tell me about it.
This is what I've been saying this whole time.
Yeah, and then she has this terribly fucked up tragic ending.
Oof.
Like, she, we get put into a... Like, this is where the brilliance of this movie really comes to a fore, where you have... We end up in a situation where all of a sudden the cops sweep in and pick up C. Thomas Howell. And just like, what? Oh, fuck. And it's like, oh, fuck. These cops have all been shit the whole time. And then Detective Estridge just strolls in. And he's just like, ha-ha. And, of course, this is Jeffrey DeMunn.
Yeah, and this is a character who earlier in the film, C. Thomas Howell spoke to on the CB radio and was like, you got to believe me, this is not me. His name's John Ryder, and he steps out of procedure and says, you know, if you'll turn yourselves in, if you let my deputies go, I'll make sure you're treated fairly. Like, there's a kinship between them, even at the point in the movie where everyone still thinks it's C. Thomas Howell.
Yeah.
So him showing up later in person at this moment, such a perfect moment for him to arrive and kind of be that one safe haven type of police officer for C. Thomas Howell, and unfortunately happens to coincide with everyone becoming aware of John Ryder in the most dramatic, graphically horrible way possible.
Yeah, but of course, this is this guy is Jeffrey DeMunn, who you guys all know. He's just not a name you know. He is one of Frank Darabont's go-to guys and is in everything great Frank Darabont has ever done. You guys will probably know him best as Dale from The Walking Dead. But he's also in Shawshank Redemption. He's in The Green Mile. Like, he's in The Mist. Like, he's and he's been in tons of stuff. But he brings that sense, you know, that talent that he had even, you know, in his youth where he's done this, and instantly brings this calming influence. But so he strolls in. He goes, "Hey, it's me." "No, it's not you. We need your help." And what we've just walked into is we think we're in a chase scenario, and instead, C. Thomas Howell walks into a traditional villain death trap.
Yes.
And the villain has set up a death trap. He is sitting in a fucking cab of a truck, and he has Jennifer Jason Leigh tied up to one end of the truck and then to the trailer.
Yeah.
And the minute he takes his foot off the clutch, the truck's going to lurch forward. So they can't shoot him. So he's just sitting in the truck, and they got him surrounded, and they need to see Thomas Howell to talk him out.
Yeah,
and that tension is so good and interesting, and shows really goes to the point of the insanity of John Ryder, because it's like, wait, this guy really doesn't give a shit if he's caught or not.
No, he's not trying to cover his tracks. He's still just trying to destroy every ounce of good inside of C. Thomas Howell's character.
And this is the first time that you really realize that, because up until this point, it makes sense that he's setting up C. Thomas Howell so that he could go off and continue doing this with everybody thinking that, you know, this kid was responsible for it and maybe this is his MO. No, it's not until this point that we really, truly begin to unravel who John Ryder is. And that's what the climax of this film is the entire climax of this film is about figuring out who John Ryder was this whole time.
Yeah.
And yeah, Jennifer Jason Leigh gets torn the fucking half.
And this is, I want to talk about this specifically, because there's a moment in this film that I am 100% applauding the filmmakers for fighting to keep it as ungraphic as possible. And that's this kill.
Yeah.
Because it cuts away, but with a combination of sound and of editing and just of the stakes that have been established, you know exactly what happens.
Yeah.
You don't need to fucking see it. It's a Jaws moment. You don't need to see that shark.
Yeah.
And that was actually something that the studios kept pushing them to. They were like, this is a horror film. It's violent in other places. It seems like this is the kind of thing horror audiences are going to like. Why don't you show? And they fought for it all the way down to the release of the film.
It's almost always the other way around.
Right?
The studio's like, can we not tear Jennifer Jason Leigh in half? She's kind of America's sweetheart
right now.
This
is a movie that got flack.
Molly Ringwald.
Yeah, this is a movie that got flack from producers for not being violent enough.
Well, and it's not violent. And that's the thing.
It's not graphic. It's violent, but it's not graphic. Like, there's a lot of carnage in this movie. There's a lot of death. There's a lot of people that go down. But there is nothing feels exploitative. Nothing lingers. Like, it is, a lot of it is implied. A lot of the death happens off screen.
No, that's exactly, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Is that, like, that first kill from the very beginning, all we know about it even being a kill is John Ryder telling us.
Yeah.
All we know of the second kill, the family in the station wagon with the boat, all we know is we see C. Thomas Howell peer into the car, we see a little bit of blood trickle on his shoe, and then he goes and throws up. We have no idea who died, we just know.
Yeah.
We don't see the police station attack. We just see the guys lying in the aftermath. Like, we do not see until the cops who are taking him, that C. Thomas Howell has hijacked us. Once it gets that far, like almost 45 minutes into the movie, that's the first time we actually see John Ryder kill anybody.
Yeah.
And they get shot.
Yeah.
But that's the first time we see, like, full on actual bloody violence. Like, it is very restrained.
Yeah.
It is almost entirely off screen, and it is brilliant that way, because it is even more affecting, because this movie is trying to shock you with the brazenness of the violence,
mm-hmm.
not with actually seeing it and the audacity of the violence.
Yeah.
Like, it's just what is impacting you is the real deaths of these people.
Yeah, and there's another moment in this movie that, on the flip side of this, they had to remove, or they had to reshoot, actually, because it's the moment that got them an X rating. And I did not even think about this as being something that would garner an X rating maybe at the time. The last shot originally was C. Thomas Howell kills Rutger Hauer not when he gets back up, but when he's still on the ground. After that crash and he goes through the windshield.
Right, because it feels like that's how it should happen.
A double tap. He's just making sure. And that was the moment that got them an X rating. So to avoid that, they had to shoot it where Rutger Hauer stands back up, so that C. Thomas Howell was at least partially justified in delivering that final shot. And to me, since this whole movie is about Rutger Hauer's character trying to destroy the innocence of C. Thomas Howell, it is so much more effective if he shoots him on the ground. In my head, I'm like, that is it.
It's a flip, because I see where you're coming from and I see where the movie ends up. I mean, yeah, I was feeling, dude, at this point, he's broken.
Yeah.
Like, this guy, of course this guy shoots him, but then he doesn't. And then then he stands up again and slowly picks up the shotgun because he's trying to get him. It's like his last chance of, please, fucking kill me. Like, he taunts him by throwing the chain.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, fucking do it.
Yeah.
And I think that works, while the killing him on the ground does a better job of defining C. Thomas Howell's final moments.
Uh-huh.
I think him standing up does the better job of defining John Ryder's final moments and defining who he was. So I think it's a six of one, half dozen the other issue.
Sure, I can see that.
And I think we really capture the destruction of C. Thomas Howell's character in that final just heartbreaking shot.
And one of the film's producers, actually, another thing I read is he attributes the film's commercial failure on that lack of violence. He argued that, you know, one, Nash's death should have been shown because there's gore in the movie, there's other killings, but the main one, you can't show all the killings, and he felt like the audience was cheated. And I don't know, to me, because there is a lot of spectacle in this movie, there's plenty that makes it, you know, a genre feast, you know, for the eyes. But because it is so reserved in the way that it depicts its violence, I feel like allows for us to get into the deeper kind of motivations of these characters. And I won't say who they are, because the film is intentionally withholding of that information. But sort of on a metaphorical level, like what they represent, like there's a lot more. It's just a way to underline that there's a lot more going on in this movie than just carnage.
Yeah. And I feel I totally agree with you. And I feel that this is The Hitcher is a movie that was just a movie out of time. Like, it's like, as we've talked about all summer, 86 is such a weird year where so much good stuff didn't work at the box office.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire market shifted over the course of a year. And this is a movie that, we talked about how it's Strangers on a Train, but it's also Duel.
Oh, is it Duel?
By way of Mad Max.
Like, is that's, it
if
ever?
If you were to describe this movie, it's Strangers on a Train meets Duel by way of Mad Max. That is what The Hitcher is.
Yeah.
And I believe that it is every bit as good to be compared to those movies. This is a movie that, had it been made and released in the late 70s, would have done amazing.
Yeah.
And had it been made and released in the mid 90s, would have done amazing.
If this were a Sam Peckinpah movie.
Because you know what movie I have always felt kind of borrowed heavily from this that I know you love?
What's that?
Breakdown.
Oh, Breakdown. I was going to mention Breakdown because that is so crazy. That was going to be the thing I was going to say at the end, because the other movie that reminds me so much of a combination of Hitchcock and George Miller is Breakdown.
And so, Breakdown, yeah, I very much
thought of Breakdown. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's but yeah, it is. It would have done well in the 90s. Like, it's that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
That right here at this spot in 86, it's just like what happened to The Thing, where, you know, if The Thing had been released 6 months earlier, it would have been a huge blockbuster. But instead, it was released a week after E.T., and nobody wanted scary aliens anymore.
So
everybody thought it was an alien knockoff, yeah, which it kind of was. But it's the greatest alien knockoff ever, and I think better than Alien. Mm-hmm. I'll argue with you guys on that. I don't think I have to. But
ring the bell, Apollo.
Yeah.
Cargo came to fight today.
Yeah, I just brought it. But it's like, that was everybody's excuse. It's like, well, shit, we don't want to see scary aliens, and we want to hug an alien.
Yeah.
And this is a movie that it's just like, it came out at a time where nobody wanted a hitchhiker killing people. Like, that wasn't...
I'm just sitting here thinking now of a Sam Peckinpah directed The Hitcher, starring Steve McQueen as the C. Thomas Howell role and Warren Oates as the crazy hitcher. Holy shit, that movie in my head. That movie in my head is fucking incredible.
That movie would be kind of fucking great.
Bring me the car keys of Alfredo Garcia. I want to see that.
So I want to talk about this character moment, because this character moment this is my big takeaway with this movie, and this is the moment that I just truly love, because it is such amazingly simple, wonderful character work. C. Thomas Howell is pulled off a bus. He steps off the bus. He's got his hands behind his head. And this cop is pissed.
Oh, yeah. Because he still looks like C. Thomas Howell's murdered cops.
Yeah. And he's like, you killed two of my friends today. He's the gun's on the ground. C. Thomas Howell's like, I'm turning myself in. And then the cop just goes, he's pointing a gun straight at him. He goes, you just spit on my hand. Wipe it off.
Yeah.
He's like, no, I don't want to. You just spit on my hand. I want you to wipe it off. And it's clear.
He wants him to reach for the gun.
He wants it to make it look like he's reaching for the gun. And you're just sitting there and you're like, how the fuck is he going to get out of this? This crazy fucking asshole cop is going to gun this down. Now, of course, this is one of those moments that when you watch it in 2016, it's like this resonates. Like, this is something that
is really on
point for where we are as a country.
It is unfortunately poignant.
Oh, yeah. Where we're just like, we get where this cop thinks he's justified.
Yeah.
Like, we get, like, this is, he thinks this is one of the bad guys. In his head, he is in a dangerous situation in that moment, and he has decided that he can and will shoot this kid. Mm-hmm. We know this kid is innocent, and that the cop is the asshole in this situation. And then all of a sudden, a gun goes off. Bam! And everybody jumps. And it's fucking Jennifer Jason Leigh. And she points the gun. And what comes out of her mouth is, Lyle, I can't believe what you were just about to do. Like, and it's just all of a sudden, like, she's shaming him.
Yeah.
And he forces her to drop the gun. And that moment, she's invested. And at that moment, we buy her going along with him. Because just 2 minutes ago, she was all but his hostage. And she was fearing for his life. And now she sees him give himself up and sees that the cops are trying to kill him.
Right.
Like, and the way she invests herself and how pissed she is at this cop who she calls by his first name.
Yeah.
She knows this guy. She has served this guy coffee
probably
every day for the last 5 years.
Everybody knows everybody. Stop. Yeah.
Everybody knows everybody. And she is pointing a gun at him and is so disappointed in who this guy is. And it's just such a great character turning moment. The movie earns her participation from that point on.
Yes.
So well, so simply, in a way that you don't see in other movies, because in other movies, how they would have done it is they would have put her in a situation with Rutger Hauer. and that being in the situation with Rutger Hauer and finally, oh, I believe you, you're not lying. No, she still doesn't know that this is all legit. But what she does know is that this guy was going to turn himself in peacefully and one of her friends is going to gun him down unlawfully and unrighteously.
Yeah.
And that just flips this sweet little hometown girl. And it is just such an amazing character moment. And it's my, of all the dark stuff, of all the crazy stuff in this movie, of all the great taut tension, the moment that she does that, it was just fist in the air. It's like, fuck yeah. I love this woman.
Absolutely.
This woman is amazing. Fuck yes, Jennifer Jason Leigh. And that makes it all the worse when the truck scene happens.
Yeah.
When she gets killed, like in fact, there's a sweet little wonderful moment where it's terrifying, but there's a sweetness to it because Rutger Hauer has crawled into bed with her.
Yeah.
And has cuddled up with her. And yeah. She kind of nuzzles into him because she thinks it's C. Thomas Howell. And then she reaches up and starts stroking his finger in a very kind of loving, like, we aren't carnally, biblically familiar with one another, but I'd like to be sort of way. And doesn't yet realize that it's Rutger Hauer until she looks up. And then we get that brief moment of recognition. And then we've cut back to the other room.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, fuck. So we see her transformation throughout this whole thing from stranger being nice to another stranger all the way up to we see this romance developing. And then, bam, all of a sudden, she's gone.
Yeah.
Like, and gone in a terrible way because her ending is super not pleasant. It's
yeah.
not just that it's violent. She's suffering that whole time.
Yeah.
And that's what breaks C. Thomas Howell. Like the look on his face, like that scene at the end when he's driving off with the cop and
tells him you're never going to be able to hold him because he's realized the depth of evil that he's dealing with and he's realized that there is no containing it.
But the great moment when Captain Estridge just looks at him and says, son, I don't know what weird thing is going on between you two, and I don't want to know. And at that moment, you realize how bonded these two men have become.
Yeah.
Like, and it's just everything in that ending is just so masterful because, like, he wants to go in and he's talked the cop into letting him go in and talk to him. And you think you're like, I've watched enough movies. This is the moment he's going to sit down, and John Ryder's been waiting for him to come in, and he's going to tell him this is why I did it. And
nope.
They stare at each other and see Thomas Howell spits in his face. And the cop's like, all right, this was a mistake.
Yeah.
And it was. It was totally a mistake. Like, no, this kid's broken.
Yeah, see, Thomas Howell should not be in that room.
He should not be in that room. And the movie is just so dark and nihilistic. And I think that's why it ultimately, if I were to guess why it really didn't work in 1986... It's not because it wasn't too violent. It's not because people really wanted Friday the 13th. It really is because the movie's nihilistic.
Yeah.
You don't walk out of The Hitcher going, fuck yeah, man.
Yeah, you don't feel good at the end.
Like, no, the movie that we're going to talk about this week on Junk Food A La Mode, you walk out going, fuck yeah, that movie was awesome. That's not The Hitcher.
Yeah.
Like, you know, The Hitcher is not a movie where you're just cheering and clapping and going, oh, fuck yeah. It's a movie where you're just like, holy fuck. And it's a gut punch. It's the kind of movie that Rob Zombie keeps trying to make.
Yeah.
Like where Rob Zombie is trying to make you walk out destroyed. It's that kind of that's why I love you bringing up Peckinpah. Cause Peckinpah's version of that nihilistic story. Yeah. That is exactly who you'd get to do that version.
It would basically
70s.
Be this, but sweatier. Like this is so Peckinpah that I don't think you'd have to change that much to make this a Peckinpah movie, except that people would be a little sweatier throughout it. And
I kind of want to see that movie that you know, with Warren Oates. What I keep thinking though is, and I'm blanking on his name. I need your help for a second, but the actor in The First Walking Tall.
Oh, Jodan Baker.
Jodan Baker has to be Captain Estridge.
And Allie Larder would probably be Nash.
There you go.
So there it is.
There's our dream casting for the 70s version of The Hitcher.
Hell yeah. And I want to kind of close out this discussion where it started, talking about there are moments where you're going to have to suspend that disbelief. And there are moments where, even though it's very stark and very bleak and very nihilistic, it gets a little fantastical. And I think that might be intentional, specifically because what this movie feels like, and especially given the inciting action, is this feels like urban legend. This feels like somebody taking a very classic American cautionary tale and embellishing. The way all urban legends, you know, the progeny of all urban legends is that, you know, they start off as a very simple story that are used to kind of push cultural mores onto people, and then people throughout time, like a game of telephone, just keep embellishing that story. And to me, that's what this movie is. This movie is a very simple cautionary urban legend. Don't pick up hitchhikers. You know, if he had a hook for a hand, it would have been all the more an urban legend kind of a thing. But as the movie goes on, it feels like you are being told, you are being warned by C. Thomas Howell's mother. You know, this is what happened to my son, so that you can tell somebody, I know a woman, this happened to her son, so that that person you tell, I have a friend who knows a woman, this happened. This is the natural progression of an urban legend.
And then, of course, he would immediately follow this up with another road movie set in the desert.
Yeah.
That was, in fact, supernatural, that goes full on with Near Dark.
Yeah. And even Cohen and Tate, you know, just continuing sort of the whole idea of, you know, what happens out there on the road. Like, that's a very common theme, I feel, for Eric Red. And this is it's so hard to pick between this and Near Dark as to what I think his best script is. I think just for the simplicity and just for maximizing, you know, very few elements, I probably have to give it to The Hitcher, just because there's so much he does with so little and creates fable, creates mythicness out of something very, very self-contained.
I feel like Near Dark's a little better. I think Near Dark like does it like perfectly. Like I think, like, you know, my love for Near Dark is huge.
Oh yeah,
and
me too.
And it like epic. And it's I mean, it's a vampire movie in which they never use the word vampire. Like it's like he gets it. And I think that's what works on both these films and connects them is he's like, you already know this story. Like, I don't need to tell you the danger of hitchhikers. Yeah. We're going to open up with, my mother told me I should never be doing this. Why? Because of what's about to happen in this movie. We just set it up for you. And then here we are, you know, what are we? We don't know.
This is the movie that proves all of your mother's right, guys. That's exactly what this is.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is what this is. This is that terrifying urban legend fable about the hitchhiker. He just doesn't have a hook for a hand.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't go there. I feel like if it were in the 90s, he would have had a hook for a hand.
Of course.
And it would have been, you know, a bunch of sexy teenagers driving around with C. Thomas Howell.
For sure.
But
we're going back to the Near Dark versus the Hitcher thing, I mean, we're really splitting Samson's hairs there.
They're both fucking brilliant. They're both brilliant scripts. They're both brilliant films. They're two of the best genre films of that decade.
I also love that Eric Red has said a lot of his inspiration for this movie came from the Doors song, Riders on the Storm.
Oh, which is nice.
Such a great, like, a little thing to inspire something like this is I think that's fantastic.
The terror starts the moment you stop for the Hitcher.
So that brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing. And this week's wasn't terribly difficult because at two different points in this movie, our characters are at dusty roadside diners along what is effectively Route 66. And if you are on a long road trip yourself, if you're driving through the night and you're in the middle of nowhere and you've officially entered like Wes Craven Hills Have Eyes territory, there is that bastion glowing in the distance of that big lighted sign. Maybe it just maybe it says Bucky's. Maybe it says Hojo. Maybe it just says Eat. It doesn't really matter. There is, at that point in time, nothing tastier than a burger and fries from the shittiest, greasiest spoon on the side of the road. There is something really magical about being on a car trip and being hungry enough that a roadside diner like this seems like five-star Michelin cuisine. And that is exactly what this movie is. This movie is something that if you just glanced at it, you might overlook it. You might think it's ordinary. You might think it's standard horror, but it is five-star Michelin junk food. And that's why I've gone with roadside diner fare, burger and fries specifically, as the junk food pairing for this movie.
Okay. I would have done orange slices. Like, they're a food that can only be eaten on a road trip. like if you showed up to a party, like, hey, bring some candy to the party, and you show up with orange slices, it would be like, fucking orange slices.
If you're the house,
like,
in the neighborhood.
If you ran into a friend and he pulls out of his bag, hey, chowing down on some orange slices, you're like, what the? Orange slices. But if somebody's on a road trip and you see those, that dangling thing, two bags for a dollar,
yeah,
you know, fuck yeah, orange slices.
That's true. And sometimes you shouldn't stop and buy that food.
No, you should not stop and get the orange slices, but you get them anyway.
Yeah. You probably shouldn't have that burger and fries at the diner anyway, but sometimes, even though your mother tells you not to, you have to do it anyway. One more weird piece of trivia before we sign off here. Apparently, George W. Bush was on the board of one of the companies that made this film. Very
George
odd.
George W. or
George
H.W.?
George W. Bush. So I thought that was very, very bizarre. Also bizarre was that the original choice for John Ryder was Sam Elliott, who had to back out at the last minute, which
that would not be the same movie.
It wouldn't be the same movie.
I love Sam Elliott.
Well, who doesn't love Sam Elliott?
Well, what was that? What's that line? There are only 10 men in the world who could pull off that mustache, and he's 9 of them.
He's 9 of them. Coors. But one of the things that's interesting about that is apparently in his audition, he scared the producer so much that the producer was afraid to walk to his car afterwards. So Sam Elliott did something in that audition that blew people away. But yeah,
It would probably be more amazing than we imagine, because I guess we do have kind of a true love affair with Sam Elliott.
Yeah.
Like, the Sam Elliott of the last 20 years has been he's just epic. He's like, from, you know, playing the cowboy in The Big Lebowski to like that, the great moment in We Were Soldiers, where like he's walking through and bullets are coming with him and he just looks annoyed that people are shooting at him. Like, he's become like epic. But yeah, no, I've never seen
Virgil Holiday and Tombstone.
I've never seen him be like truly like.
Yeah, but
scary.
That's the thing about that is the
Maybe
thing.
Could have been.
That is the thing about Sam Elliott, is we always want Sam Elliott to be good. We cannot wrap our heads around him being anything but the paradigm of virtue because he's a goddamn cowboy.
Yeah, no.
And if you take our cowboys from us, are you listening, Sam Peckinpah? If you take our cowboys from us, what do we have left?
Yeah, he's kind of the last cowboy.
Yeah, he really kind of
like
is.
When Sam's gone, like, it's like, yep, there are no cowboys left.
God. Much like this movie, we are ending on a bleak note, and I am okay with that. If you would like to hear more of our bleak notes, our upbeat notes, and us ranting about all things cinema, you can check out our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or at twitter.com/massaworm. Or this week, you can find me over on Rage Select. I did two episodes with Professor Jeff over there discussing the new Deus Ex video game.
Very cool. You can find me on Twitter at Bri Guy Salisbury. You can also find my page on Facebook, facebook.com/Brian Salisbury Critic. And if you have a few extra shekels to throw into the hat, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Lots of bonus content just for patrons, including the possibility of a very masochistic new bonus show that will invite you to force me to watch whatever you send me. So yeah, think about that for a while, why don't you? And we're gonna end this show with just a fair warning here. Never ever pick up a stranger unless, you know, you're sitting on your right arm. And no,
or
I'm gonna stick
hot. Like,
or if she's hot, yeah,
if we've established that's how porn movies start.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm.